Hampshire Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's been 70 years since a new global financial system was hammered out in 3 weeks of high-stakes international meetings held in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. And the results of this conference, the so-called Bretton Woods Accords, are often credited with helping stabilize the world economy by creating two new institutions, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. But now, 7 decades later, the economic facts on the ground have changed. The U.S. is no longer the world's biggest creditor nation, it's the biggest debtor. Meanwhile, Europe has its own unified currency, and China has become an economic powerhouse to the point where it may set up its own Bretton Woods-type system with a select handful of other countries. All this uncertainty has led some analysts to call for another international meeting of the minds. As The Economist magazine put it, perhaps it is time to send another group of dignitaries to New Hampshire. Today in The Exchange, do we need another Bretton Woods Accord? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And joining us from Hanover is Matt Slaughter. He's economics professor and associate dean at Dartmouth Tuck School of Business. He's also faculty director at the Center for Global Business and Government. And Matt, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here.
And later on during the hour, we'll hear from the author of a new book called The Battle for Bretton Woods, more about the behind-the-scenes history of this event. Again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. So, Matt, you wrote an article about this recently, looking back 70 years, and you said, how does today's stewardship of the global economy compare to that of 1944? You said the diplomatic answer would be not well at all. Make that comparison for us, if you could.
So let's go back to spring of 1944. The Allied powers were still locked in a life-threatening battle with the Axis powers. It was very unclear what the end of World War II was going to be. And yet at that time, the United States, Britain, and many of its allied countries came together in Bretton Woods to think about what the international economic system could and should look like if the war was won by the Allies. So it was a very unsure time in the world. And yet you had a set of countries that came together that were thinking creatively, they were collaborating, and they were thinking about the long term. And I think a lot of us would agree there's just a striking difference in the United States and a lot of other countries today where the thinking of a lot of the policy leaders is a little more partisan, a little more focused on the short term, and not quite as creative.
Well, you say today's global economy is in many ways hobbled by stale, partisan, short-term thinking. The victims are companies, workers, and their families around the world, all unable to grow and thrive as much as they could. So, you know, this is more about more, Matt, than just, you know, diplomats looking good and having nice, shiny agreements. This matters.
Oh, absolutely. This is not just diplomats flying on airplanes to nice places to talk with themselves. So think about where we are today in the world economy. Think of a few issues that really matter for Americans and for us here in New Hampshire. Think about the United States and China, now the two largest economies in the world. And we're embroiled in a pretty bitter dispute about China's lack of protection of intellectual property. So one of the things that the United States is really good at, a lot of our companies in New Hampshire and elsewhere in the country, is creating new ideas. Think of the innovative companies like Google and Apple and Microsoft. Well, those companies are struggling on a daily basis today with the Chinese government and other actors in China aggressively trying to steal their ideas and intellectual property. And that matters because those companies can't grow as much in the world and can't create as many jobs in New Hampshire and elsewhere. So that's one example, I think, of how these ideas, when policymakers struggle to have a framework of how the economic system is going to work, it really ultimately cascades back to workers and their families.
What was the world economy like 70 years ago, Matt? It almost seems amazing that they were able to focus on the economy, given that the war was still raging. But what was the global economic picture when these representatives from 44 countries came to New Hampshire and sat down?
Yeah, that's a great question. You might think, my goodness, the war was so in the forefront of everyone's mind.
Right.
And it clearly was. But there was enough wisdom to look back and say, if the war ends as we hope, we need to create a different economic system from what we had in the previous few decades. From 1914 up until the time of the Bretton Woods Agreement, those 30 years in the world economic system were extremely chaotic. You had the disaster created by World War I in terms of the loss of human life and economic activity. But in the interwar years, there was a lot of turmoil in the global economy. You had a lot of countries whose currency regimes fell apart. A lot of countries tried to make ends meet by printing money. In fact, one of the reasons of the rise of Hitler to power was the hyperinflation in Germany in the early 1920s. And then as the Great Depression took hold around the world, a lot of countries enacted very severe restrictions on international trade and investment that compounded rather than improved the problems of the Great Depression.
So the thinking, Matt, was all this economic turmoil and these, you know, crashes that we saw. And I remember seeing pictures, you know, in history books of Germans running around with, you know, wheelbarrows full of Deutschmarks as the inflation went crazy.
Right.
The thinking at Bretton Woods was, look, this is leading not just to financial instability, but to violence, to world war, and it has to stop.
Absolutely. So it was a classic example where economic turmoil in Europe and elsewhere impinging on the day-to-day lives of people and workers and companies had clear political implications. And so the thinking of Bretton Woods was, let's envision a future after the war where we're going to create a different set of financial arrangements. That was the International Monetary Fund. A way to rebuild the world. That was the World Bank. And a way to have the exchange of goods and services across borders be something like it was before all the tariffs and problems during the Great Depression. So that was the International Trade Organization.
I definitely want to ask you about those three institutions, Matt. Let me also invite our listeners again to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Or again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. As we look back 70 years since the Bretton Woods Accords in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, at the Mount Washington Hotel, we're looking at what happened at those meetings and whether the results of that conference is still relevant today. Do we even need another Bretton Woods Accord? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. So without getting too detailed, Matt, because it's complicated, but what were these three institutions? Let's start with the International Monetary Fund. That's the biggie that comes out of Bretton Woods.
That was the biggie. So the IMF, it was envisioned to be an entity that would help the flow of capital around the world. The lifeblood of how a lot of international commerce happens is loans between banks and loans among companies. The methods by which loans were made and capital flowed became extremely damaged in the interwar years. So the IMF was envisioned to do a couple of big things. One is the F, a fund. It was literally a kitty where the member countries agreed to pay in billions of dollars collectively so that member countries of the IMF, if they found themselves in financial trouble, could take a loan against the IMF and stabilize the operations of their country. And related to that, the IMF members agreed, rather than try to competitively devalue their currencies, that is, print more money and reduce the value of their currency and make their goods less expensive in world markets to sell more goods, to create more jobs, the countries agreed, when we all try to do that, no one ends up winning. So the IMF set up an agreement where countries would fix the value of their currencies to each other. And in turn, and some listeners may remember this, the value of the U.S. dollar is fixed to gold at $35 an ounce.
That's the complaint we hear about China these days, right? That they're devaluing their currency on purpose so that their stuff is really cheap and so that everybody, especially the United States, will buy it.
Great point. And this is an example on how the initial agreements of the IMF to have a set of fixed exchange rates and to have a method to change those exchange rates when the economic conditions warranted, that intention and function isn't working as well today per the U.S.-China friction that we see.
So is this system still kind of up and running, or have we kind of set it aside?
It is still up and running, although how the IMF functions today is quite different from how it started, in large part because in the early 1970s, the United States and many other countries went off that fixed exchange rate system.
The gold standard, yeah.
Exactly. The gold standard, for a set of reasons, fell apart in the early 1970s. Rather than close its doors, the IMF, I think, wisely said, it's a new world in terms of how finance is working. Let's change our mandate and let's think about still supporting financial stability in the world and still have this fund that countries today still tap into when they encounter financial trouble.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you about the emerging, evolving role of the World Bank as well, Matt. But let's take some calls from our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. And let's go to Henniker, where Richard's on the air. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi. Interesting program. I'm interested in the relationship between the Bretton Woods Conference and the goals and ideals of that conference and the beginning of the whole debate in Europe in the 1950s, which led towards the unification of Europe and eventually the monetary unification of the Eurozone.
This is a great question, Richard. Thank you very much for calling in. You know, I wonder, back at that time, Matt, did anybody even conceive of a unified European currency? I mean, not all European countries are in it, but 17 or 18 are.
Boy, great question, Richard. And at the time, probably not. If we could go back and read the minds of Keynes and the great scholars
right.
and policymakers that were there, I think they were thinking about the world overall. But I think part of the success of the Bretton Woods agreements was it fostered an awareness in Europe in particular, which, remember, had seen two devastating wars start in the first part of the 20th century there. European leaders realized this effort to integrate, to find ways to connect through trade and investment in a set of agreed-upon rules can help generate prosperity that hopefully supports peace. So a lot of the early policy and business leaders in the 1950s in Europe, such as Monet, Jean Monnet was a French leader that was one of the visionaries to help lay the foundation for the European Union, started to realize we could create similar institutions among ourselves just in Europe. And so the original agreement was among six countries in Western Europe to have a trade agreement on the trade of coal and steel, actually. It was one of the seminal early Europe-specific agreements that today, many decades later, has led to the euro, the common currency, and a whole host of other arrangements to tie their economies together.
And Richard's right. These conversations started, you know, pretty early in the 50s, so not really that far out from Bretton Woods, Matt.
Not at all. And especially because, remember, the agreement, though it was a productive 21 days in Bretton Woods in 1944, it took a number of years after the Bretton Woods meetings to actually have the agreements and the institutions be created, come into existence, start to create staff, start to make loans and do things like that.
Well, it's kind of amazing when you think about it, that people actually sat down, figured this out, and went beyond to the point where now we see, more than two dozen European countries having a unified currency, probably inconceivable back at that time. We will talk more in just a moment. And you can join us, too, like Richard did, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email. And coming up, we'll hear from the author of a new book called The Battle of Bretton Woods. All that in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR.org is your source for stories about New Hampshire you won't hear anywhere else. Click over right now to read Sean Hurley's story about a free summer camp where kids who love to write are being introduced to hiking as inspiration. Learn something new about New Hampshire every day at NHPR.org. Partly sunny today, highs upper 70s to around 80 degrees. Mostly cloudy tonight, chance of showers after midnight, lows from upper 50s to mid-60s. And we have a flash flood watch in effect for tomorrow with rain heavy at times. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Dartmouth-Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare, a sustainable system improving the health of our communities for generations to come. Imagine.d-h.org. And the New London Bar and Playhouse, a professional summer theater presenting Cole Porter's classic musical, Kiss Me, Kate, now through August 17th. Information and tickets at nlbarn.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, 70 years ago this summer, the Bretton Woods Accord was signed, setting up an international financial system that leaders hoped would lead to a new, more stable global economy. Now many people are asking, 70 years later, do we need another Bretton Woods? Or is this whole approach established 70 years ago irrelevant in today's economy? Let's get your questions and thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guest for the hour is Matt Slaughter, economics professor and associate dean at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. And in a few minutes, we'll hear from the author of a new book called The Battle of Bretton Woods. And Matt, a few minutes ago, we were talking about just what was established there at Bretton Woods 70 years ago. You talked about the IMF, the role it plays today. What about the World Bank? At the time, it was supposed to just bricks and mortar, right? I mean, help rebuild everything that had been destroyed in the war.
Exactly. So bricks and mortar is a nice metaphor for that, Laura. Think of the IMF as intending to make big loans to national governments to help stabilize their fiscal regime and help stabilize their financial systems. As a complement to that, the World Bank was intended at a more project level, kind of the micro level sometimes it's called, to make loans to help build particular infrastructure projects and help rebuild the foundation of economies, especially those that have been damaged or destroyed by World War II. So think of this as loans to rebuild roads, to rebuild dams, build electrical systems. There was an understanding that, especially after what the damage that had been sustained in World War I, there was going to need to be this kind of brick-and-mortar redevelopment in parts of the world. And so the World Bank was set up to do that kind of lending to member countries.
And same question, Matt, that I asked you about the IMF. So, you know, that was what it was supposed to be. Did it turn out to be that?
It did, although when you look at the bank today, I think it's challenged in a couple of ways. One is, no disrespect to the very good people that have worked at the bank over the many decades, doing sound project development loans is tricky. Part of the problem that the bank has encountered over the many decades is some sovereign governments around the world, they're not always as transparent as we would like, and it's been difficult sometimes for the World Bank to come into countries and make loans that end up creating projects that help local communities and businesses in the way intended. And I think a second challenge is actually a paradox of its the success of both the bank and the International Monetary Fund, which is today world capital markets are a lot more developed than they were in 1944. So more voices today are saying, golly, do companies and sovereign governments around the world really need the World Bank for loans when there's a lot of commercial banks they can borrow from, they can borrow directly on international bond markets? So today the bank, I think, faces a little bit more of an existential question of what role should we be playing in the world today that is much more developed to support economic development?
Yeah, and a criticism that I have heard for years over at the, about the World Bank is that it favors sort of giant, easy-to-document projects like dams and highways instead of the local village-by-village development that in the end might help more people long-term. That's been the criticism for many decades. I wonder if that's still the criticism, or is the World Bank, you know, kind of up with the new focus on microloans and individual entrepreneurs?
The bank's definitely up on that focus. Its previous president, Bob Zelick, was very wise in recognizing the need to bring new scholarship on the value of microloans into the bank's practice and be more transparent. And its current president, former Dartmouth president Jim Kim, has continued with the effort to be more open. I think you put hit the nail on the head, though, which is it's harder for an institution based in Washington, D.C. to make sound microloans in thousands and thousands of communities around the world where you don't necessarily have the local context and information to make sure those loans really help the people and businesses intended.
Well, given all those resources that you talked about, other sources of lending, and, you know, you even have people coming together over the internet and starting up microloans and so forth. You got Kickstarter campaigns and so forth. Maybe we don't even need the World Bank anymore. Maybe we can just do it on our own.
Well put, and some people are saying that. And I think the bank, in a very existential sense, is thinking about how to answer that question. My view is there's still a role for the bank to provide the kinds of loans that the market doesn't necessarily make. If you, for example, think about loans to develop basic infrastructure in poor countries and to address healthcare needs, the market doesn't always magically step in as neat as Kickstarter and things are like that to address those basic human needs. And I think another thing the bank has migrated towards in providing to the world is basic information. One of the things the bank has done very well is it collects a lot of information about economic performance and development in these countries. And the more they can share that information with governments, non-governmental organizations, the private sector, that's an important role that I think it can continue to play in the future.
Yeah, if you're a data geek, the World Bank has a lot of data on all the countries around the world. It's kind of fun if you're into it. Let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Today in Exchange, looking back 70 years of the Bretton Woods Accords signed here in New Hampshire in the summer of 1944. We're looking at what happened there, how it relates to us today. And Aaron's calling from Alton Bay. Hi, Aaron. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to kind of pose a couple-part question for your guest, and I'm sure many of your listeners may know also that there's certainly the IMF and World Bank both have tended to fall under a lot of criticism and even quite large protests around the world, for that matter. And I'm wondering if what that comes from is is the oftentimes I'm under the understanding that there's many strings attached to different global governments, and oftentimes in these infrastructure loans and everything else oftentimes go to corporations, and then there's certain, like I said, strings attached that governments must do that oftentimes facilitate trade agreements and whatnot, and that actually end up leading to more destabilization of the regions and even governments that are taking place in these loans. And I'd like your guest to comment on that, if that's possible.
That is a great point, Aaron. And he's right, Matt. The IMF and the World Bank are often targeted for hurting instead of helping, you know, with the various requirements that countries have to sometimes make, big budget cuts or opening up their agricultural trade markets or their other trade markets. And there are people who feel like these institutions aren't helping. In fact, they're hurting. Thanks for the question, Aaron.
Aaron, yeah, that's a great question. I'll answer it in a couple of ways. One of the metaphors that I think is very apt here for understanding how the bank and the fund function is criticizing their presence in countries, especially countries in crisis, is a bit like criticizing doctors for being present where there are a lot of sick people. And so I think the important message there is the bank and fund have endeavored, not always perfectly, but they've endeavored to try to bring what I'll call the best practice of economic policymaking to countries that ask for their help. So, for example, again, we mentioned Germany earlier in this conversation in the early 1920s. A classic example that governments, when they get into trouble balancing how much they want to spend relative to taxes coming in, when they try to make up the gap of insufficient taxes relative to spending by printing money, printing money is only a short-term solution that ends up creating massive problems if it's left unchecked. So one of the things the bank and fund has done over the many decades is countries experiencing financial crisis, they often come in and do say, as a condition for receiving loans from us, you have to change your economic policymaking. Often that has meant you need to slow the rate of money supply growth, you need to cut spending and raise taxes, and often to try to build economic growth, they've said you need to try to connect to the rest of the world by opening up to international trade and investment, by bringing down barriers to those connections to the world. Those policies are often controversial in host countries, in part because of the broad principle that some governments and citizens say of here's these international institutions infringing on our sovereignty. That's an ongoing conversation that those institutions still face today. But I think, again, the metaphor of the doctors helping the sick patients, if you take as a given, as I do, that there's some knowledge about how to better do economic policy around the world, then the bank and the fund, going back to their inception in Bretton Woods, have tried to function by saying to member countries, we will help you if you agree to try to help yourself by pursuing better policies.
Well,
again,
Aaron,
the bank and fund haven't been perfect. And to their credit, I think they've done a better job in recent years of acknowledging there are times where we need to vary the policy advice we give based on the political and economic context of particular countries. So they're not perfect institutions, but they've been learning, I think.
Maybe some of those protests have helped. What do you think?
I think so. I think over the years, literally the people that sometimes protest in Washington at the annual meetings of the bank and the fund where they have to cordon off streets, the leaders of these institutions have realized there's legitimate grievances against how we operate around the world that we really need to take on board. Good advice, if not well delivered, is not going to be taken up. We know that in doctor-patient relationships or family relationships, but it's the same with the bank and the fund.
Well, as we look at what happened 70 years ago at Bretton Woods and the legacy of that conference, we're talking now with Ben Steele. He's Director of International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the new book, The Battle of Bretton Woods, John Maynard Keynes, Harry Dexter White, and the Making of a New World Order. And Ben Steele, thank you for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into all the backroom dealing and your narrative about Bretton Woods, I have to ask you, because we are New Hampshire Public Radio, Ben, why Bretton Woods, New Hampshire? Why the Mount Washington Hotel? Why not New York City or Chicago or Boston?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there were two main reasons. First of all, FDR and his Treasury Secretary, Henry Morgenthau, wanted to have the conference far away from the gloom and heat of Washington in July. As you can imagine, that was not the sort of place that was conducive to pleasant international discussions. But more importantly, FDR was determined not to make the same mistakes that Woodrow Wilson had made 25 years earlier at Versailles. He was determined to bring along the Republicans. And there was a New Hampshire senator, Charles Toby, known as an isolationist and an opponent of international organizations, who was going to be facing a tough primary battle in the fall. And FDR reasoned that if he brought the conference to New Hampshire, he might be able to win over Toby, and Toby, in turn, would win over many of his Republican colleagues. And indeed, that's exactly what happened.
So was there a lot of positive local publicity around this conference, you know, and Senator Toby gets all the credit?
Toby was he was one of the delegates, American delegates, and he was naturally very, very happy to attract the spotlight to himself. As to the Mount Washington Hotel itself, the owner was actually very reticent about hosting the institution.
Really?
Yes. First of all, the hotel had been closed for 2 years before the conference started. They actually had the military sprucing it up at the last moment to get it into functional condition. But also there was this sense that having all these exotic peoples from all over the world was not really a New Hampshire sort of thing. This would be very, very dangerous. There was actually an incident early on in the conference where the Chinese delegation went on a hike in the mountains and got shot at by a hermit who suspected that they might be Japanese invaders.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, Ben, you learn something new every day. Thank you for that. So in the end, Roosevelt, you know, he has his way. He says it has to be here. It has to be at the Mount Washington Hotel. They open it up. They dust the cobwebs out and they get together. And in your book, you write, Ben, that this narrative of the world coming together, figuring this out, you say, maybe yes, but your narrative seems to be, if I could summarize, it's all about America getting its way.
That's right. FDR's treasury was really quite ruthless in their ambition to exploit the situation during the war, in particular the fact that Great Britain, whom they considered to be America's natural geopolitical rival in the world, was quickly going bankrupt. And they determined that this was a great opportunity to basically cut a deal with the British. We'll give you financial assistance to get through the war and the immediate post-war period, but in return, we want you to agree to certain conditions that will basically make the United States unrivaled politically and economically on the global stage. And one component of this was indeed Bretton Woods, which established a dollar-centric international monetary system, which continues on to this very day. So Bretton Woods, in effect, really dethroned the pound sterling as a major international reserve currency.
Yeah, and you write about how, you know, John Maynard Keynes, the famous British economist, was there pushing for Britain time and time and time again. He gets shot down to the point where he's just sort of emotionally battered and bruised at the end. Why didn't Keynes get anything he wanted? I mean, nothing.
Yeah, well, Keynes generally didn't lose his arguments intellectually, but he didn't have money to back it up. The vision that Keynes and the British brought to Bretton Woods was actually very different from the American vision. Keynes wanted to establish a new international currency, which would be called the Bancor, which he hoped would eventually supplant the U.S. dollar as the dominant international currency. He wanted the IMF not to be a powerful international institution dominated by the Americans and domiciled in Washington, but a sort of passive mechanism that would provide financing to countries that were basically in Britain's situation. In other words, debtors who had balance of payments problems. But he lost all those arguments, not just at Bretton Woods, I should emphasize, but in 2 years of very contentious negotiations with Treasury official Harry Dexter White and his Treasury colleagues in the run-up to the conference.
Well, I want to bring Matt Slaughter into this as well and remind our listeners that you can join us with your questions, comments about this Bretton Woods conference 70 years ago this summer, the legacy of that conference, what came out of it, how it relates to us today. The number 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Matt, what do you think about some of the stories that Ben's telling us? Not about Chinese diplomats being shot at in the woods, but the idea that the British came, they had their agenda, hugely different from the U.S. vision, and the U.S. basically just muscled its way through.
Ben's insights in his new book are tremendous, and I think one of the points that I'll stress is, I'd frame it this way. I think the art of leadership is when and how to shape opinion and when and how to respond to it. And those two verbs, shape and respond, are quite different. And I think Ben's work on this has illuminated that. Bretton Woods was a telling example that is still present today in the world's economy of sometimes you need entities, whether it's a country or the personalities involved, to say, here's what people are saying, let's respond to that and follow that. And other times it's different, and you need countries and or individuals who will lead in shaping opinion and say, here's a problem and here's a solution that I think on balance is the one to do. Now, Ben has illuminated there's a lot of real politics and real finance that was behind how Bretton Woods played out. The United States at that point was clearly, in a lot of economic and financial senses, the dominant power in the world economy. Part of the challenge today in the world is the United States is not as strong of an economy as it was at that time. And our ability to shape institutions today, such as the World Trade Organization, is a lot less than it used to be.
Yeah, so
Matt
yeah.
makes an Go important ahead. Point that the position that the United States took in the 1940s was a position that we took when we were the world's dominant creditor. And Britain was the world's dominant debtor. Today, United States is the world's largest international debtor, and China is the world's dominant international creditor. And indeed, Chinese officials use the same language today to describe the problems in the global monetary system as the Americans did in the 1940s. And we're actually using many of the same arguments that Keynes used in the 1940s.
Really?
Yes.
Exactly.
The idea, because the roles have reversed, we're saying some
Precisely.
Of the things that Britain said when they were the world's biggest
Exactly.
debtor.
In the 1940s, we wanted fixed exchange rates because there was so much upward pressure on the dollar, and we wanted to keep the dollar down. Now we want flexible exchange rates because there's downward pressure on the dollar, and we want other countries to accommodate this. When Tim Geithner, former Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, suggested in 2010 that caps should be imposed on persistent current account surpluses, this was, of course, aimed at China. This was exactly the sort of thing that the United States was determined not to accept at Bretton Woods in the 1940s, despite the fact that other countries' debtors wanted such provisions.
All right. And after a short break, I have a lot more questions for both of you about how this whole institutions that were set up at Bretton Woods relate to us today. We'll hear from you, too. Your questions and comments are welcome. So keep it right here.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the latest on Iraq and the potential for long-term U.S. involvement. Then a preview of the Scottish vote for independence from the U.K. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Partly sunny across New Hampshire today with high temperatures upper 70s to around 80 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the Bank of New Hampshire Pavilion at Meadowbrook, presenting the Moody Blues Thursday, August 14th at 7 p.m. Tickets online at banknhpavilion.com. And the Wealth Management Group at Merrimack County Savings Bank, trust and wealth management services provided by advisors committed to your financial needs. TheMerrimack.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the growing backyard chicken trend in New Hampshire. We'll find out more tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, we're taking a closer look at the Bretton Woods Accords 70 years ago, how they tried to change the international financial system, the personalities behind this deal that happened in that small New Hampshire town at the Mount Washington Hotel, and what it all means for us today. You can join us with your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests, Matt Slaughter, economics professor and associate dean at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business, also faculty director at the Center for Global Business and Government. And with us is Ben Steele, director of international economics at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the new book, The Battle of Bretton Woods. We've been hearing some of the stories from that conference 70 years ago and talking about how these stories affect us today. The number again, 1-800-892-6477. 6477. And Matt, to you, I was fascinated by what Ben was saying just before the break, the idea that, you know, we went into Bretton Woods, the biggest creditor, now we're the biggest debtor, and we're making some of the same arguments that Britain made back then when they were in debt trouble. I'd love your thoughts on how the whole world has changed. The tables are upside down, it seems.
Indeed they are in many ways. So at a couple levels, it's striking the parallels that Ben highlighted there. For better or for worse, the United States today, given large fiscal deficits we've run for a long time and the fact that households don't save a lot, given how these things are measured, the United States today collectively is the largest single debtor in the world in terms of the total amount of that we've borrowed from other countries. The Chinese leaders are wise, and they recognize the historical parallel, and it is not lost on them. I think one of the challenges that our two countries face, given that we're the two largest economies in the world today, is how to move past the kind of language that we've been using, and in particular how the United States can negotiate and try to frame up ideas and agreements with China in a way that doesn't come across in some basic sense as the debtor going to the creditor saying, hey, could we have different, easier terms? Just like an individual that has borrowed a lot from the bank doesn't necessarily have a lot of leverage on the bank when they talk about things. So is it with the United States and China today.
So here's my big question for both of you. And I'll turn to you first, I think, Matt. But Ben, obviously, I want to hear from you, too. What's needed today, Matt, along this Bretton Woods model? Is there a new institution, a new set of financial rules that if you were invited to, you know, Bretton Woods 2.0, if I could call it that, that you would suggest?
The biggest thing I think, great question. I think two things. One is a meeting would need to be convened. And then there's this complicated question of who's at the table and how many countries get invited.
Right.
Given that there's been such growth in countries like China and India and Brazil, these BRIC and beyond countries, legitimately, a lot of them that are much bigger economically want more voice in the policy institutions that exist. So that's an important challenge. So you got to get the seating chart right. But I think what the second ingredient that would be even more important once everyone's there is, frankly, just some new ideas. I think part of what was creative, though it was real politics, has been pointed out in some ways, was the IMF and the bank and the International Trade Organization, the third institution envisioned there, in many ways were quite revolutionary relative to where the world was then for how to have the international system operate. So new ideas needed today, for example, would mean things like, how are we going to have countries agree to respect intellectual property? We talked about that a little bit earlier. That is a massive concern for so many innovative American companies, especially vis-a-vis China. I think another big policy idea to be addressed is, how do we try to agree to have international transactions in services? Again, back in 1945, most of international commerce was goods.
Right.
It was things built in a factory and put on a boat in Cleveland and sent somewhere. Today, so much of what we do in the United States and other countries is we create these services, educational services, consulting services, allowing companies and therefore their workers to connect with foreign customers and services would be great. And we've made some progress in that in recent years, but there's so much more progress that we could be made. So the key issue, I think, is the new ideas and a new creative way to try to have countries find common agreement on areas that matter to all of them today.
Ben, what do you think? I'm making you Harry Dexter White, the American leader at this. You're now Harry Dexter White. What do you propose for 2014 at the new Bretton Woods?
Harry Dexter White actually believed fundamentally that the United States could only maintain the global predominance of the dollar if the dollar were indelibly backed by gold, and that turned out not to be true. In 1971, Nixon closed the gold window and made the dollar inconvertible, but the dollar still did continue on. So Harry Dexter White didn't have that quite right. He was a staunch monetary nationalist, and no doubt that if he were in the Treasury today, he would be looking for ways to shore up international role of the U.S. dollar. What's quite interesting is the Chinese perspective. In 2009, Chinese Central Bank Governor Zhou Xiaotuan made a rather dramatic statement that appeared on the front pages of most major newspapers, suggesting that Bretton Woods had been a terrible mistake, that we should not have pursued the White Plan, but we should have pursued the Keynes Plan for creating a new international reserve currency. Keynes wanted to call it Bancor. The problem in terms of getting from where we are today to where Governor Zhou or Keynes wanted to get is that the two major players on the global stage, the United States and China, are not willing to subordinate their interest in the monetary sphere to the requirements of a new international currency. The United States is not willing to relinquish control over U.S. dollar interest rates, which are basically the interest rates that determine other rates around the world. And China is not willing to relinquish control over its exchange rate.
So, yeah, that's what I'm wondering, too, Ben, is even if you and other smart people came up to New Hampshire and crafted the best system possible, would anybody even play along? Sounds like you're saying no, Ben.
No. In the 1940s, we had a unique set of circumstances. There were two major countries in the world that were basically determinant in terms of global financial stability, the United States and Great Britain. And over the course of 2 years of contentious negotiations, they hammered out a deal. Basically, the United States would get Britain through the war and a brief post-war transition period, in return for which the British would relinquish the economic foundations of its empire. It would get rid of imperial trade preference. It would make the pound sterling, again, fully convertible into dollars at a fixed exchange rate. This was actually a mortal threat to British solvency. But today, there's really no such deal to be done between the U.S. and China. For example, in 1956, we kicked the British out of Suez by threatening to provoke a sterling crisis, withholding vital IMF support for the British. And we could do that at no cost to ourselves because U.S. holdings of British securities in the 1950s were trivial, amounting to about $1 per U.S. resident. But Chinese holdings of U.S. securities today amount to about $1,000 per Chinese resident. So if China tried to provoke a dollar crisis in order to change our behavior, at least in the short run, they'd be hurting themselves as much as they'd be hurting us.
So we kind of have this mutual distrust, but also mutual reliance, Ben.
Absolutely, completely. We are very dependent on Chinese capital fund our deficits. The Chinese are major holders of U.S. Treasury securities, and China, of course, is very dependent on the U.S. dollar and manages its exchange rate very carefully as a means of controlling its economy.
Let's go to another call, if we could. And Andrew's in Keene. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. This question may have already been partially answered, but I was curious. Given the preponderance of loans and its role in the economy today, does Keynes balance or trade model even can it even go forward as a useful model?
Andrew, thanks a lot. And I think he's got an economics background, Matt. So if you can give us just a little bit of explanation of what that balance of trade model is and then answer the question. Thank you, Andrew, very much.
Great question, Andrew. The Keynes balance of trade model referred to the reality, which is countries can have imbalances in a given year with how much they trade with each other in goods and services. That has to be offset by an equal but opposite in sign amount of imbalance in trade and loans, given that countries tend to not give things to each other for free. And so I think the deeper question that Andrew is asking there is how much can countries be indebted to each other? How large can loans be? I'll connect this back with Ben's insights a moment ago about the interdependency between the United States and China. Again, the United States has built up large trade deficits with the rest of the world. We've been borrowing a lot from the rest of the world for many decades now to fund consumption over production here. China has become one of our largest creditors. And kind of here we are today trying to figure out the disagreements that we currently have between our two major countries on financial issues that Ben nicely articulated. But I'll come back to your good question, Laura, about if we could convene another Bretton Woods, what would happen there? Again, I think Ben's insights and Andrew's question underscore the need for something like this, to try to create the space where leaders can try to find common interests. If you look at public opinion surveys in China today, people there are very concerned about a set of issues which aren't too dissimilar to here. They're concerned about income inequality and corruption. They're concerned about job creation and slowing economic growth. And especially in China today, much more than in America, they're concerned about pollution, ambient air in Beijing and things like this. So those are hard issues, I admit, And again, it built on Andrew's good question about loans and things. But the need for a second Bretton Woods, I think, is very clear, which is space where leaders can try to find common understanding and some kind of agreement. Ben is right that there was a happenstance of agreement between Britain and the U.S. in 1944. Something like that might be creatable if enough time and effort were put in between important countries in the world today like China and the U.S.
Well, and speaking of, you know, would there be another Bretton Woods? What would happen? We have a great email from Tom who says, great of you to provide this historical perspective and update. Listeners may be interested to know that a significant gathering of economists and world leaders did meet again at Bretton Woods in the spring of 2011. Five Nobel laureates, the head of the World Bank, George Soros, Prime Minister Gordon Brown, captains of finance and politics, and a lot of security. Tom says he was there. He says the Institute for New Economic Thinking was the sponsor. So that's real interesting, Tom, and I had forgotten about that. Thank you for that email. Here's another one from Ben in Hudson. He says, could your guest discuss the possibility that an Eastern European, Middle East, and Asian currency trade agreement, especially involving India and Russia, could undermine U.S. monetary supremacy and what effect that could have on our economy? Thanks for that email, Ben in Hudson. And Ben Steele, do you want to tackle that, the idea of other groups going out on their own?
As you know, the so-called BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, recently agreed to create a new development bank. And it would take on some of the same roles that the World Bank has today. It would make development loans first among those five nations, later on further abroad. It would also take on some of the roles of the International Monetary Fund. For example, there would be what's called a contingent reserve arrangement that would allow these countries, at least in principle, to borrow excess dollar reserves from each other in a crisis. But that's just to show you how difficult it is to change the current international financial architecture. The Russian president, Vladimir Putin, praised this new BRICS bank for helping to end dollar hegemony in the world. 100% of the initial subscribed capital of this new BRICS Development Bank, $50 billion, will be in U.S. dollars and U.S. dollars only. In contrast, 90% of the capital of the World Bank is in other currencies.
Wow. So what are we to make of that? I mean, it almost seems like there's two messages there, Ben.
Yeah, I'm. Look, Matt's absolutely right that other countries want a more voice in the international financial architecture, but it's not clear that they want to do things fundamentally differently or that they're even able to do so. For example, the Brazilian finance minister has criticized the so-called Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, for being less than fully democratic. Well, the BRICS Bank is not going to be democratic by any means. If you read the fine print of their agreement, for example, they've assured themselves that no matter how the institution may grow in the future, the five founding members will always control 55% of the votes.
Sounds like the UN Security Council, doesn't it?
Precisely. So, and basically, they are replicating many of the features of the Bretton Woods institution, but they're just doing it in another context.
Imitation's the best form of flattery, Matt.
Absolutely.
Indeed. And yeah. I think Ben's point there points out part of how the world could make progress with the policy challenges we've been discussing today isn't necessarily with creating new institutions and new banks. It would be taking the existing ones and changing their rules of governance and process and allow them to focus on more relevant issues that are matter today. So that Ben's question alluded to India, and India is the one major country in the world today that has stopped a major trade agreement in the World Trade Organization that was agreed upon through arduous negotiations over the past couple years to facilitate the ability of goods to move through customs across countries. Kind of a weedy issue, but really important for businesses and their workers and customers to see higher quality, lower cost products. But one country, India, was the major one to step forward a couple weeks ago and say, you know what, we don't like this agreement. And because the WTO currently functions on predominantly consensus, one country in the 100-plus members of the WTO can stand up and say, I don't like this agreement, it's not going to go forward. So these issues of governance that Ben just alluded to in the context of the IMF and the bank, they're relevant for all these Bretton Woods institutions we're talking about.
Okay, very quickly, because we're running close to the end. The Economist magazine said, looking back in an opinion piece, perhaps it is time to send another group of dignitaries to New Hampshire, given all the instability in the world economy today. Real quickly, Ben, what do you think? Do you agree or not?
No, I don't. It's not time to do that yet. And the reason I say that is because Bretton Woods was not built in 21 days at the conference in July of 1944. 90% of the details that were ultimately agreed to at Bretton Woods were hammered out in 2 years of very contentious negotiations between the Americans and the British in the run-up to the conference. We would need something similar today before it would be useful to convene such a conference. That would be the U.S. and China sitting down and hammering out a new arrangement by which those two powers could live. And then those two nations would have to sell the idea to the rest of the world.
Super quick, Matt, what do you think?
I think it'd be a great idea. We need to get the leaders together, though, first, on Ben's insight, to set up people for the hard work to follow.
All right. Both of you, great stuff. Thank you so much for being here. Ben Steele, it was good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Ben Steele, he's with the Council on Foreign Relations, author of the new book, The Battle of Bretton Woods. Matt Slaughter, a pleasure as always. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Laura.
Matt Slaughter, economics professor and associate dean at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. The Exchange is a production of NHPR, and we say goodbye and many thanks today to our terrific intern, Renee Taylor, who's heading back to school in Holland. Sounds like fun, Renee. We'll miss you. Thanks for all the great work. I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the burgeoning backyard chicken movement in New Hampshire. As more Granite Staters set up coops, some of their neighbors are crowing over the noise, and local governments are having to step in. We'll find out more, then composters clamor for fewer regulations on their heaps in the Granite State. Send us your thoughts by email, post pictures of your chickens on our Facebook page, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
These are the stations.
The Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where we get support from you, our listeners. And support also comes to us from Rothweigel Dental Care in Bedford, comprehensive family and cosmetic dentistry. Devoted to restoring and enhancing the natural beauty of your smile, information at rothweigeldentalcare.com. And from Bellamy Fields Assisted Living in Dover, more information on geriatrics with a sense of humor online at bellamyfields.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. For the first time since American troop withdrawal in 2011, the U.S. conducted multiple airstrikes in Iraq this week. They're aimed at halting the advance of Islamic State militants in the north. The U.S. attacks are the start of what President Obama called a long-term project in the region. The U.S. also worked to free tens of thousands of Christian minorities trapped by Islamic State fighters. In Baghdad, political tensions rose sharply. Despite increasing pressure, Prime Minister Maliki refused to relinquish power to his newly nominated replacement. The latest on Iraq and the U.S. role there. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Iranian officials have joined other world leaders in welcoming the appointment of a new Iraqi prime minister. NPR's Allison Muse reports the U.S. has already congratulated Prime Minister-designate Haider al-Abadi.
In Baghdad, eyewitnesses say that tanks and security forces loyal to current Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki that appeared earlier seem to be thinning out. Last night, Maliki gave a defiant speech vowing to challenge the legality of his replacement. But Iraq's president has already congratulated Prime Minister-designate Abadi, saying, "I hope you'll be successful in forming a broader-based government." Iranian security official Ali Shamkhani is voicing support for the political process, and President Obama says an inclusive government is the only way forward for Iraq, which is battling Sunni extremists set on creating their own state. Maliki legally remains prime minister until a new cabinet is formed. That should happen in the next 30 days. Allison Muse, NPR News.
Meanwhile, the U.S. is supplying Iraqi Kurds with weapons. They're fighting Islamist militants in northern Iraq. The U.S. has already conducted airstrikes on some militant positions. Oscar-winning actor and comedian Robin Williams has died. He was 63. Police in Marin County, California, say his death appears to be a suicide. Williams' publicist says he had been battling severe depression. Williams came to national attention.